coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Violations of horseshoe crab harvesting rules last year at Kitsummit has some asking Delaware to take action.
What they'd like to see is for the legislature to pass a bill that would ban horseshoe crab harvesting.
Contributor John Hurdle examines last year's harvesting issues and what they could mean for protecting horseshoe crabs. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn what you need to know about next week's solar eclipse. Arts Playlist highlights a Delaware Art Museum exhibit focused on recognition of people of color in artistic spaces. And History Matters explores the story of two Delawareans who fought together during the American Revolution. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The annual horseshoe crab spawning season is approaching, and a number of conservationists are urging Delaware environmental officials to step up enforcement of a ban on the harvest of those crabs this May and June. This comes after a handful of harvesters violated the rules at Kitsummit in 2023. This week, contributor John Hurdle examines what happened last year at Kitsummit and the response to it in his latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to explain what's going on and what to expect this year. So, John, before we get into what happened at Kitsummit last year, can you tell us a little bit about what the rules are in Delaware for harvesting horseshoe crabs right now and why having these rules in place is important?
Well, DENREC's rules are that there is to be no harvesting of horseshoe crabs during the spawning season, which is from May 1st until June 30th. But there's an exception to that rule, which is that owner of a private property can invite crab harvesters onto his or her land to gather the crabs up for bait. But the rule states that that person may operate only on that land and not on any adjoining properties. So that has created certain degree of confusion as we're reporting about Kitsummit. Now, I mean, the aim here is to protect horseshoe crab species that depend horseshoe crabs and the species that depend on them during the spawning season. And we should say that federal regulation does actually allow for horseshoe crabs to be harvested off Delaware. And in fact, the Fisheries Commission has set an annual quota for recent years, continuing this year in 2024. But it's significant that they only allow male crabs to be harvested. They set a zero quota for female crabs because they're aware about public concern that the eggs laid by female crabs feed migrating red knots and other shorebirds as they migrate through the Delaware Bay each spring.
So, John, beyond the state rules that you just mentioned and some of the federal guidance, Kitsummit has also signed on to be a horseshoe crab sanctuary. That is part of the story as well. What does that entail?
Well, that is a voluntary agreement between residents of about a dozen coastal towns that they will not allow horseshoe crab harvesting on their properties, and they will also not what's called harden their shorelines. That hardening means the building of bulkheads or jetties, that kind of building which would prevent crabs getting onto the sandy beaches where they lay their eggs.
Despite that sanctuary status, there was some harvesting done at Kitsummit last year, as your reporting indicated. How did that come to be, and why did it wind up sparking this issue we're reporting on this week?
Well, what happened was that a handful of Kitsummit residents invited harvesters onto their properties. And those harvesters went to the Kitsummit along the beach and along those properties for a couple of weeks in June of last year, and they collected horseshoe crabs in wagons and in boats, and that led to some confrontations by people who had signed up, who were part of this sanctuary, But the problem was that that even though the harvesters were, if they had stayed within the private properties of the folks who had invited them there, that would have been perfectly legal. But as Denrek has confirmed to me, they strayed off those properties onto adjoining properties, which were owned by folks who were part of the sanctuary, and onto the intertidal zone, which is owned by Denrek, which does not allow horseshoe crab harvesting during the spawning season, as we've said. So that's what's happened. That's what happened last year, and that is what the conservationists are afraid will happen again during the spawning season this year.
So you've mentioned a little bit about what Denrek had to say about what happened last year. What are they saying about, as you said, what might happen this year? What is their approach to enforcing this going forward based on what happened last year?
What they say, Denrek, is that they're going to well, first of all, they've been in discussions with the Attorney General's office to establish exactly what the rules are, where the harvesting areas are and are not allowed, and so they have clarified that for themselves, and they're saying that they will write to all of the parties involved here to make sure that everybody's on the same page and everybody knows what the rules are and what the harvesters, should they show up, may and may not do.
So this issue, as you've noted, has kind of reignited some calls from advocates about legislative action on harvesting issues to protect the crabs and, by extension, the red knot and other shorebirds. What are advocates looking for lawmakers specifically to do to address this issue? What would they like to see?
Well, what they'd like to see is for the legislature to pass a bill that would ban horseshoe crab harvesting. And if Delaware did have such a law, then it would be following New Jersey on the other side of the bay, which has had such a law in place, at least as far as the bait harvest is concerned, since 2008. I mean, what the naturalists say, and this includes Delaware Audubon and other advocates for birds, is that the horseshoe crab population in the bay has not fully recovered from a very sharp overharvest during the early 2000s, and consequently the population of red knots reflects that. And it may be significant that in the last migration seasons, migration/spawning season in 2023, only about 10% of the red knots that were observed bay-wide actually showed up on Delaware beaches. And what naturalists say is that reflects the fact that there's still a horseshoe crab harvest allowed by Delaware, and that Delaware does not close some beaches which are favored by the migrating birds during that time.
But your reporting indicates that there's not likely to be any kind of legislation coming at least this year from the General Assembly. Why is that? And what are the arguments from lawmakers that there's no need for action right now?
Well, what I've heard from Senator Stephanie Hansen, she's the chair of the Senate Environment Committee and a very active environmentalist in various areas. She points out that the permitted harvest of horseshoe crabs in Delaware, if they were all gathered for this year, would only be around about less than half of 1% of the estimated total population of horseshoe crabs in the bay, which is estimated to be around 30 million. So she says that the population is beginning to recover. And she also argues that she has been active on trying to protect the horseshoe crab in various ways, including talking to the pharmaceutical industry, trying to get them to, rather than using crab blood for the creation of one of their biomedical products, is to switch to a synthetic alternative, and that's an issue which conservationists have been pushing pretty hard on for the last several years, in the hope that you know, if the industry makes that switch in significant numbers, it's going to reduce the incentive for the fishing industry to catch horseshoe crabs.
You also note that State Senator Stephanie Hansen said she could change her mind on this issue. What were some of the things that she said that would prompt her to maybe revisit this and perhaps eventually offer some legislation?
She's waiting to see whether NOAA, that is the federal agency, is going to list the horseshoe crab as an endangered or threatened species. A couple of dozen environmental groups wrote to NOAA back in February, urging it to do so, and what Senator Hansen says is that, you know, if the federal government does decide that that the horseshoe crab needs special protection, then, you know, that may cause her to change her mind on whether to sponsor some legislation in Delaware.
So, John, based on the people you've talked to for this story, what is the likelihood of action on horseshoe crab harvesting, short term and long term?
Well, it doesn't seem likely that there's going to be a bill this session. I mean, I also spoke with Representative Deborah Heffernan. She heads the Assembly Environment Committee, and she wasn't about to introduce a bill either. So it seems pretty unlikely that that's going to happen this year. But you know, there's clearly public support for protecting red knots. I mean, the Fisheries Commission has recognized that repeatedly. And so I think that we should really watch the migration numbers of the red knot and other shorebirds this spring. And if they're low again, baywide or perhaps just in Delaware, then, you know, there may be renewed pressure from the conservation community for Delaware to step up.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. John's piece on horseshoe crab harvesting in the first state is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We check in with the University of Delaware astronomy professor about next week's solar eclipse and how best to watch it. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. And I'm Tom Byrne. Nighttime is usually the best time to observe astronomical wonders, but daytime is the only time to see a solar eclipse. This Monday, April 8th, millions will gather across the United States to witness the first total solar eclipse in 7 years. And although the first state isn't in the coveted path of totality, Delawareans will still experience a partial eclipse if the weather holds up. Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon spoke this week with UD Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Sally Dodson-Robinson, about the total solar eclipse and where to view the rare cosmic event.
Sally, I think everyone or most of everyone listening to this already knows about the total solar eclipse coming up on this Monday, the 8th. That's when the moon will pass between the sun and Earth, which will block the face of the sun outside of, you know, that surface level general understanding. I'm not sure a lot of people, you know, me included, have a good grasp on the science and the context and maybe even the history behind the eclipse, but that's where you come in. So let's build from the bottom up here. What exactly is a total solar eclipse? You know, why is it happening now? What's the magic in this April 8th date?
Well, there's no particular magic. What happens is that the moon's orbit is tilted about 5 degrees with respect to the Earth's orbit around the sun. So if the moon and Earth's orbit were perfectly lined up, we would get a total eclipse once every month, but they're not. So when we get a total eclipse, it's just when the moon happens to be crossing the same plane in which the Earth orbits the sun, and it crosses that plane right in front of our path to the sun, essentially. Because of this misalignment in the orbital planes, twice every month, the moon goes through the plane of the Earth's orbit. And if it happens to go through the plane exactly along the line between the Earth and the Sun, then you get an eclipse.
So the last time the U.S. had a total solar eclipse from coast to coast was August 21st, 2017. And there are some qualifiers with where you'll be able to specifically see the next total solar eclipse cycles, so to speak. But the next one will be, for those out there interested, the next one will be March 30th, 2033. And the one after that will be on August 23rd, 2044. And just for good measure, the so-called greatest American eclipse is in 2045. But so can you give us a little more context about how long, you know, this kind of cosmic event has been happening and how rare eclipses really are? I mean, I assume these have been going on since the beginning of all things. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. They're not rare at all. In order to get a recurrence of an eclipse in the same location, you have to wait about 54 years. So from the perspective of a human lifetime, that is a long time. And you can imagine in ancient times, this would have been pretty scary, right? So this is something that only happens once every 54 years, which means one person is going to see a maximum of two of them in their lifetime. And if you're not writing down and keeping records, then you might not see that, oh, this is a regular pattern and it happens and nothing's wrong. Everything goes back to normal. It looks like end times. So it's definitely scary, but this has been happening forever. And the reason it takes 54 years to get around the entire eclipse cycle so that you can see the same eclipse from the same location on Earth again is simply because the actual cycle of just the moon blocking the sunlight as seen from Earth in a total eclipse is a third as long. So that eclipses that you total eclipses that you see somewhere on the Earth happen three times as frequently, but just there is an 8-hour time lag between each of these eclipses. So you wait 18 years, but then there's an 8-hour time lag. And so you wait 18 years for the next one. That eclipse hits somewhere around the other side of the Earth because of this 8-hour time difference. And so you have no way of knowing, oh yeah, there is an eclipse happening somewhere on another continent. So, I mean, if there weren't this little 8 hours extra in the recurrence time between eclipses, then they would happen three times as often and people would have gotten used to them a lot sooner.
So the last time, as I just said, the last time the U.S. had a total solar eclipse was August 21st, 2017. This time around, the path of totality where, you know, all people can see the eclipse, that path is supposed to be wider and more populated. And the totality will supposedly last longer than it did 7 years ago. Can you break down those two things a little bit for us and, you know, just how else this eclipse will be different than 2017's?
The totality is, I don't believe it's any wider in terms of the amount of area that it covers on the surface of the Earth. But what's going to happen is that the amount of the totality, of the path of the totality that is over the United States is larger than it is last time. So that means that people over a wider swath of the country will have the opportunity to see it this time. So it's not like the eclipse is going to last longer. They just last about 2 minutes and that's it. It's just that in terms of the timing of the eclipse, the path will happen to take it across the continent this time and across essentially the diagonal across the United States.
That's interesting. Yeah, this year's eclipse crosses from Mexico into Texas up to Spain and it exits over Canada. So for us Delawareans, we are unfortunately not close to that all-coveted path of totality viewing. You know, fear not, we'll still be able to experience a partial eclipse. And I believe that's only obscured around 86 to 88%. Sally, if we're planning to stay in Delaware for this, where would be the best spots to see the eclipse? Again, if we're not trying to go outside the state, we can get to that maybe in next question, but just for Delaware, where are the best, most optimal, you know, viewing conditions?
Well, you can see it anywhere there's sunshine. So As long as you look up in the sky and you can see the sun, then you can see the eclipse. So you don't actually have to travel at all to get good viewing conditions. All you need, let's just cross our fingers that the clouds stay away. You just need some good weather. And so a really good way to see it actually is if you take a colander outside and you just let the sun shine through the holes. If you do that on a normal day, the spots of light that you get shining through the holes will be round, but if you do it during the eclipse, they'll be little crescents.
Well, if we're going around Delaware, maybe if you don't have to necessarily hoof it, go all the way up to, Maine or something like that, where, regionally to get closer to that path of totality, what do you think there as far as a better view of the eclipse?
Well, you have to go right along the path of totality in order to actually see it get fully dark. So, if you have an 86 to 88% eclipse, what that means is, let's say right in the middle, 87% of the surface of the sun is blocked from our eyes. So, that's a lot. It's going to be way darker than usual. But unfortunately, you won't notice that if you step outside because your eye is very good at adjusting to different lighting conditions. So when you're in your house at night and you have the lights on, those lights are way less bright than the sun is in the day, but you can still see as normal within your house at night. And so what your eye will do is it will just adjust to the lower lighting conditions that you get from having 87% of the surface of the sun blocked. And so it won't look like anything at all. It will not look interesting at all. Unless you actually use some kind of either eclipse glasses or a telescope with a solar filter on it, or if you try the colander trick, that's how you'll get to see the eclipse. But otherwise, if you just step outside and you hope to be aware of the eclipse just based on the fact that it's darker, your eyes are going to trick you and you're not going to notice that.
Like in terms of where you are, obviously, yeah, wherever you see the sun, you would rather be somewhere like a maybe like when we're thinking of like the micro of it all, you'd rather be somewhere like an open field than maybe like smack dab downtown, like a if you were on a rooftop downtown, like that would be better, or like an open field if you were, let's say you're, southern Delaware and the beaches, like going out to a space like the beaches, would that be like more preferred, or is it really just get out wherever you can clearly see the sun and you're good to go?
Yeah, that's all you have to do. So for nighttime astronomy, that matters a lot. You definitely want to be in an open field if you can, where the horizon is unobstructed, so that if you want to look at your favorite object in the sky, there's not a big building there. And you want low light pollution because you can't see anything faint if you have a lot of light pollution. And the I-95 is just ridiculously light polluted. So ideally, you would get very far away from the I-95 for nighttime astronomy. But for the eclipse, if you can't go to the path of totality, which is where it will really get fully dark as night, then it really doesn't matter to see the partial eclipse. You can be in your front yard, you can be on your roof if you like that, if you want to. You can go to an open field, but it won't make the experience any better.
Well, where are you watching then? What are your plans look like?
Yeah, I will be watching from Delaware, actually. Unfortunately, I am not traveling to see the eclipse. I do kind of wish I had made the arrangements and just pulled my daughter out of school and said, we're going. But my thought was, well, I'm still supposed to teach and my husband's still supposed to teach. It turns out a lot of my students are just going to see the eclipse anyway. So in terms of teaching, that may not be very necessary. I might not have very many people in my class, but there are some students at University of Delaware who are going down to Texas, and they're going to actually launch a balloon to hopefully get some observations during the eclipse. So keep your fingers crossed for them.
That's very cool. If it is overcast in like any capacity, you won't will you still be it like and you put on your, your solar eclipse glasses, your special solar eclipse glasses, you'll be able to will you still be able to see the eclipse happen if it is overcast or just not at all?
No, unfortunately, you won't. You have to be able to actually see the disk of the sun in the sky. And you, even during an eclipse, you should never look directly at the sun. So it's not safe to just look up there and see, like, oh, can I see the crescent shape where the moon is blocking most of the sun? You definitely need to use equipment. Eclipse glasses are great, but sometimes the little cardboard ones, either if they don't fit perfectly or if they get holes in them, then that can also be dangerous. So you want to use a solar viewer or a telescope with a solar filter on it, or a good trustworthy pair of eclipse glasses, or try the colander trick. But you don't ever want to just look at the sun. But unfortunately, if it's cloudy, none of those tricks are going to work. All you're going to see is clouds. So let's just really, really hope that the clouds stay away.
Yeah, we'll put our chakras together. When it comes to obviously smartphones are also a thing. People taking pictures of the eclipse, people documenting the eclipse, digitally, whether it's with photos or videos. What do you think about that? And do you have any other kind of best practices, best safety tips for listeners out there?
So I haven't looked into how to do it with a smartphone, and your success of doing it would just depend on how short your shutter speed can get. So even if you are looking at the sun during an eclipse, it's still incredibly bright. So you're going to need the shutter of that camera to just open and close really quickly. But if you can get a short enough shutter speed, it would work, or you could put in a filter. So you could put a filter over that lens, and it would block a lot of the light, and then you would be able to take a good picture. As long as you're covering your eyes, you could line up that shot, and that would be fine.
Thanks to UD Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Sally Dodson Robinson, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, and a look at a new Delaware Art Museum exhibit that examines the representation and recognition of people of color in artistic spaces. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Artistic spaces have historically excluded people of color. Such artists have always existed, but the art world hasn't always acknowledged them. That's been particularly apparent for black women. And to help showcase their presence in American art over the past two centuries, the exhibit, There is a Woman in Every Color, Black Women in Art, is now open at the Delaware Art Museum. And in this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel is joined by Delaware Art Museum Curator of American Art, Heather Campbell Coyle, to learn more about this exhibit and representation in art.
There is a Woman in Every Color, Black Women in Art, takes a closer look at the representation of black women over the past two centuries and black women's presence in American art history. This is a traveling exhibit. It was originally put together by art historian Elizabeth Humphrey. Let's talk a little bit about her and about that original conception. Her background, her work, let's start with that.
Sure. So Elizabeth attended Bowdoin, and she was working there. She was on a fellowship after graduation and put together this exhibition in 2021, and culled from their collections. Really, she was really interested in, sort of the rarity of representation of Black women in art, of women that looked like her in the museum on the campus where she had done her undergraduate work, a campus that has more and more young Black women attending. And so for her, it was about sort of, looking through, finding the representations, and creating an exhibition that showcased those works.
And this was an opportunity, too, for the museum because of something that the Delaware Art Museum has been doing over the last few years, and that's some acquisitions, right?
Yes. We were really excited to have the opportunity to bring this exhibition to the Delaware Art Museum. It's traveling through the auspices of Art Bridges, but we knew when we looked at it, we were really excited about the content, but it was too small for our space. And we realized that this was a great opportunity to expand with work that we had acquired recently. And then realizing that Elizabeth herself was getting her PhD at the University of Delaware, it seemed too good of an opportunity to miss. So we invited her in to look at some of our recent acquisitions. The Delaware Art Museum has been focused on acquiring work by women and artists of color, and of course, therefore, women of color as well, for many years, but specifically really for the past 10, it's been a big focus. So being able to have someone go through and pull out some of those earlier works, like a Faith Ringgold we acquired in around 2000, works by Joyce Scott, you know, being able to look at those, but then also look at this cluster of works that we've acquired in recent years and start to tell those stories from the perspective of a Black woman teaching and, you know, working in American art right now.
It seems like in curation, often it's a very lonely kind of area because you curate an individual event. But in this particular case, you get to work with somebody. Is that a little bit different as you approach curation of a project?
Absolutely. I love working collaboratively. It's a lot of fun. And in this case, just having that different perspective, a perspective that not only reflects art history, which is what I'm educated in, but also that it reflects lived experience. I mean, I couldn't do the same work in curating an exhibition of Black women in art as Elizabeth could. Not only is it her particular specialty, you know, historically, but also it is, you know, her identity. And I think it's really important for museums to bring people in to collaborate with us so that we can tell new stories and see the work that we've acquired in a new perspective.
Let's dig into the exhibit just a little bit. There is A Woman in Every Color by Elizabeth Catlett is in the exhibit, correct?
Yes. So that is in the opening section, which is called Patterns of Visibility. And that section includes a lot of earlier work, including photography, a marble sculpture by Edmonia Lewis, one of the first really recognized, successful Black women sculptors. So this work exhibition is not all work by Black women artists. It's also images of Black women artists, and some works are both. But having you know, photographs of Black women taken in the 19th century, sometimes we don't even know who took them, but it's unlikely to have been a Black woman. In some cases, we do. But so it starts with this idea of patterns of visibility. But the Catlett work is, you know, from the 70s. So the show is organized not chronologically, but thematically. So it starts with this idea of visibility, you know, just seeing Black women in art for, and that's probably the most, you know, it goes back to a Sojourner Truth photograph from the 1860s and all the way up to the work of Micheline Thomas, a very contemporary artist, and also includes nudes. She brought in an Edward Loper from our collection that is only viewed occasionally, a nude he did, probably of his first wife, which is really lovely, and paired that with a group of photographic nudes.
Let's take a step back a little bit at the larger issue of representation, barriers for artists of color. In art, identity is central to the work an artist does. This exhibit more than recognizes people of color in artistic spaces. When it comes to exhibits like There Is a Woman in Every Color and museums like Delaware Art Museum that showcase them, it's a pretty big role in addressing the lack of representation of people in color in artistic spaces. How do you think we're doing with that?
Well, we still have a long way to go. I think museums are really engaged in a concerted effort at the moment. I just came back from the extraordinary Harlem Renaissance exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You know, museums are beginning to try to tell these stories, but we are limited in some cases by our collections and by the availability of works. So, you know, in both Bowdoin Museum's collection and in the Delaware Art Museum's collection, work by Black women artists is less than 1% of what we own. So you're just not working with, you know, as vast a collection as you'd like to be. But museums are actively collecting this work now, both buying contemporary work, and I'm a curator actually of historical art. I stop around 1960, but trying to find works, acquire works, broaden our collections, that helps us broaden the stories we can tell in many years to come. I just encourage people to come and see the incredible diversity of production in the show. Some of the work is abstract. It's not all representational, and it's in every medium. A really exciting show visually.
Thanks to the Delaware Art Museum's Curator of American Art, Heather Campbell Coyle, and our Carl Lengel for joining us on Arts Playlist. And we wrap up The Green next with History Matters and our conversation with the author of a new book on the lives of two Delawareans that fought together for nearly 8 years during the American Revolution. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Robert Kirkwood and Peter Jacquet were more than just contemporaries serving in the Delaware Continental Regiment during the American Revolution. They were close battle buddies who fought alongside each other for nearly 8 years. To document their time together on and off the battlefield, Delaware Air National Guard and U.S. Air Force veteran Brigadier General Kennard Wiggins Jr. wrote Delaware Patriot Heroes. In this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon sits down with Brigadier General Wiggins for a closer look at the intertwined lives of Kirkwood and Jacquet.
Delaware Patriot Heroes is your 9th book with more to come. So this isn't your first rodeo, but when did you realize you wanted to write this book and shine a light specifically on Robert Kirkwood and Peter Jacquet?
This actually wasn't my idea so much as I had been asked by the Peter Jacquet chapter of the Sons of the American Revolution to give a talk. And it was on an entirely different topic, but one of the fellows asked me, he said, "We don't have anything on the history of Peter Jacquet. We just have a couple of paragraphs. Do you know anything? Because I serve as the archivist and curator for the Delaware Military Museum." And so I did a little bit of, you know, minor research, just the sort of the low-hanging fruit, and put together a paper. And he asked me to give a talk on Peter Jacquet based on that paper, which I did. And that was sort of the germ of the idea. Later, that chapter became joined with the Robert Kirkwood chapter of the Sons of the American Revolution. So he said, could you do a talk about Robert Kirkwood and Peter Jacquet? You know, and so I did some research on those guys. And it just sort of evolved in the direction of a book that that really the chapter wanted to publish. And I was just trying to help him out. And so now we have the Delaware Patriot Heroes book, which is their title, by the way, not mine, but that's okay.
Well, let's take a closer look at Robert and Peter then. They each led their respective companies through 32 battles over roughly 8 years of war. So that's a lot of fighting. Right. But, you know, winding things back a little bit, do we have an idea or a sense of how Robert and Peter essentially got into the military? You know, did they, you know, what does or did that process look like for them back then? And if not them, if we're not exactly sure, you know, if you could give us a sense of what that process looked like overall for the average soldier.
Yeah. Well, they, both of them, joined Colonel Hazlitt's regiment in, January of 1775. Both of these fellows, Kirkwood was the son of a prominent preacher, prominent family around Newark. Jacquet was the son of another prominent family. So they became officers. They became ensigns and lieutenants and so on. So they didn't enlist as enlisted men. They were officers going in. So they were kind of part of the elite when they joined.
Just dovetailing off what you just said, can you describe that relationship a little more for us? You know, how that bond kind of manifested itself on and off the battlefield, maybe what kind of men they were, what made them different, and again, how they leaned on each other and what really seems like the best of times and the worst of times.
Right. Well, when you go back through the historical record, you know, there's a thing called the Delaware Archives, which is about a 5-volume history of Delaware's participation. And it's filled with rosters of soldiers and expenses for, you know, food and cattle and horse feed. And it's often not very illuminating. There are some letters and orders, and you kind of have to piece it together. It's hard to get your arms around what the person was really like, because these are sort of official documents. Then you hear, you know, anecdotes from different folks. The record is a little bit spotty. Kirkwood wrote, so did Jacquet, so you get to know him a little bit that way. But after researching these guys over a period of time, you begin to get a sense of what you think they were like. And my impression of Kirkwood was he was charismatic. He was he made it up as he went along. He was a great innovator. He was a good guy, an idea guy. There's no description of him. There's no pictures of him, but I would have to say he must have been attractive. He must have been athletic. He must have been, you know, one of those guys that, you know, I like that guy. I want to follow that guy anywhere.
Yeah.
So I think that's the kind of fellow that Kirkwood is. Jacquet was a little different. He was sort of steady. He was the rock. He was the guy you wanted to depend on in a battle. You know, you wanted him next to you because he's not going to scare easy. He's not going to run away. He's going to stand there and face it. And he's a tough guy. He endured, well, they both endured a lot of hardships all through the war. But, you know, my sense is Kirkwood was kind of the glamour guy and Jacquet was the sort of the solid rock. And that's not exactly very scientific. It's sort of based on a lot of impressions over looking at a lot of research and hearing a lot of stories. You know, nobody actually described them in those terms, but I do, just from my impressions from researching these folks.
How would you characterize that? Would you characterize this like relationship as unusual, given like your experience and being a war historian?
No, I don't think it's unusual at all. Okay. In fact, in my experience, sort of the greater the hardship, the tighter the bond. Typically, you know, when you're under stress, you really need to rely on the guy next to you. And so that I'm sure that happened in the revolution. It always happens. So it's almost universal, I think. And there's just no doubt in my mind about that.
Are there any other stories that stick out to you? Again, we're talking about a good period of time, not only when they obviously knew each other and had this relationship, but, you know, over this 8 years, you know, roughly 8 years of war. But what are some other stories that stand out to you? You know, what sticks out to you on that score from the book?
One of the things that sticks out is, you know, I like to stay in shape and I aim to get my 10,000 steps a day with my little gadget and do my walk every day and get my exercise. That's about 4 miles. And it's kind of hard to do oftentimes. I mean, it takes, you know, over an hour and, you know, it's probably more exercise than I need. But these guys, the Delaware Regiment, and Kirkwood records this in his diary, typically marched anywhere from 16 miles to 24 miles every day. Now, they've got a pack on their back with their bedroll and they're carrying a musket. They've got not much to eat. Their gear wore out. Some of them were barefoot. And they did this day after day after day. The hardships that they endured, just the physical hardships, were kind of hard to imagine, really. They're really difficult over really rough ground, through the thickets of the Carolinas and through the swamps and in the heat. The Carolinas were, especially in the summertime, were a very unhealthy place to be. There was a lot of disease. There were more casualties from disease than probably from combat during that southern campaign. So just the hardship of carrying on was very, very difficult. And so that's one of the things that struck me. Another thing that kind of struck me was their treatment after the war. They had been promised pay. They had been promised land after the war. They didn't get paid. And if they did, they got paid in Continentals, which were almost worthless. There had been inflation during the war. And so these folks, Jacquet came home to his farm. He had a farm outside of Wilmington along the Christiana River called Long Point. During the course of the war, it had not been tended. So the dikes broke, his land got flooded. His house was in disrepair. His crops were ruined. His animals were gone. This is what he came home to. He was a broken man. He had no money. He was in ill health, and he's got nothing at the end of the war. And he petitioned the state of Delaware for relief, and really didn't get any. Those are some, you know, these hardships were really quite remarkable that these guys endured, and both of them, to a greater or lesser extent.
You know, there's a lot to get from, I think, a book like this, whether it's the historical value and the personal value of Peter and Robert's story. But what do you hope people who give Delaware Patriot Heroes a read, you know, what do you hope they take away from it?
Well, you know, I think somewhere in the advertising blurbs, it says, you know, you may have driven down the Kirkwood Highway, but does anybody really know who Kirkwood is? And I think... I mean, I did as a kid because I grew up in Newark and I knew a little bit about Kirkwood, and but I really probably most people don't, and so if I can fill that hole, I think that's important, especially with the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence coming up. There's a thing called Delaware 250 that I'll put a plug in for. They're a big effort to celebrate, you know, throughout the state coming up in 2024. So I hope this is sort of timely and it you know, is part of that curriculum and helps to fill in folks' knowledge on the revolution itself and on these two folks in particular. I think it's important to know where we come from.
Thanks to Brigadier General Kennard Wiggins Jr. and our Kyle McKinnon for showing us why history matters this week. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Carl Lengel, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.